Those of you that read the programme, Dharma Gita wrote the blurb for this, probably this time last year, actually. We all want happiness. We all think we know how to get it. And we all think we know what it is we want that's going to make us happy. But often we're going about it in the wrong way, or we're chasing after the wrong things. Most of us, if not all of us, have been influenced in our lives by the media, advertising, our families, the culture we've been brought up in, and our education. And we've been influenced by all of those things to think that certain things will make us happy. So I've got a list of a few different things that I think would have made me happy in my 20s. So with just the right job, just the right size house and the right position with the right size garden, the right number of bedrooms, the right lover, it's not this one, it's the next one that's going to be the right one, or partner if you're not a commitment phobe. If only I was a bit older, so that's when you're young, you think, if only I was a bit older, I could vote. If only I was a bit older, I could drink. If only I was a bit younger, now we're getting a bit older, that's the way we're thinking. If only I was a bit younger, I could get off this sofa easily. I wish my friend would or wouldn't call me. Wish my friend would call me more or wouldn't call me as much. Usually there's one or the other. With just a little bit more money, I wouldn't have to blur. But the Buddha says, I mean, some of those things didn't exist in the Buddha's time, but the Buddha says none of these things is deeply satisfying. None of these things truly touches the deepest longings of the heart. So I suppose our task is to find out what those deepest longings are before we can even make a decision about what is going to make us happy and how to go about it. What is the deepest longing of the heart? So I'm just going to outline a little bit about the very first teaching of the Buddha. So this came just after his enlightenment. And he sat for a long time after his enlightenment, I think it's about 6 weeks, with a period of reflection, internal dialogue, wondering what he was going to teach, wondering how he was going to teach. He'd just had this amazingly profound experience. Dharma Gita touched on it last night when she was describing the Buddha and that limitless potential that all of us have got it within us. So the Buddha had attained this point of realizing that potential and that it was still limitless. And how was he going to communicate it to others? So he was in India, so he decided to use a formula that's used in India for medicine. So he was thinking that his teaching was medicine for a very sick world. So I'll just outline that for you, and it's called the Four Noble Truths. So the first one: there is suffering inherent in life. This is the disease. So there's a disease. When the Buddha initially went on his quest to attain enlightenment, although that's not what he called it at the time, he was trying to get beyond old age, sickness and death. He was trying to work out a way to fix this disease. And the first teaching he gives, there is suffering inherent in life. Two, he identified the poison. There is a cause. I'm not going to talk too much about that one today, but there is a cause of our suffering. Three, the medicine. There is a cure. And four, administration of the medicine. This is the cure. And then he went on to give the first teaching of how to go beyond suffering. So these are the Four Noble Truths. And it is worth reflecting at different stages on each of those to find out whether you totally agree with it. And there's lots written about each of them, but I'm going to just focus on the first noble truth about the disease. There is suffering inherent in life. And the word given for suffering is dukkha in this case. Dukkha. And in a lot of books and a lot of writings, it is translated just directly as suffering. But there's also another translation that I found really useful when I first started reflecting on this, and that is dissatisfaction. And there's an image of an ill-fitting chariot wheel. So you can imagine a chariot would have been two-wheeled chariot being drawn by an oxen or a cow or a horse or something. And one of the wheels is just slightly off kilter. So you're sitting on the chariot. If they were both on, it would be a nice smooth ride, even if it was a bit of a bumpy road. With an ill-fitting chariot wheel, not only does the animal pulling the cart get more tired more quickly, but actually it makes the ride a bit uncomfortable, a bit dissatisfying. So that's the image for you. But interestingly, when I first read this, my personal response was, that's not true. Suffering isn't inherent in life. And so I had to do a lot of reflection on thinking, is it definitely, or is it just that people in their own minds create suffering? So I was doing a solitary, actually. It was just after I'd been on Dharma Gita's retreat here. So it's within 6 months of coming across the movement, and I was reading the Guide to the Buddhist Path, came across the Four Noble Truths, and I just thought, I don't know, is suffering inherent in life? And then I thought, okay, I'll go for a walk and reflect on this. So I put some oatcakes in my bag, got my water ready. It was a bright blue sky, sunny day, and I was thinking, this is just beautiful, it's just beautiful. Summer, gorgeous. Thought I better put my Gore-Tex jacket and my waterproofs in my rucksack in case it rains. And then I put my rucksack on my back and it was a bit heavy. And then I walked out of the caravan and I started walking up the hill and I was a bit of a slog. And I was thinking, "Oh, my rucksack's really heavy." And I had what is known now for me as a Gore-Tex moment. So I realised that, of course, for me, there isn't a dissatisfaction in life if I've got my Gore-Tex and my water and my oatcakes and my rucksack and enough money and a nice warm dry bed and comfort and this and that and the other. But if I didn't have any of those things, the anxiety of going, or even knowledge of where I was going and a path through the woods, if I didn't have any of those things, then that walk could have been suffering or dissatisfaction. I could have got soaking wet, I could have caught pneumonia, all these kind of things, all these anxieties that I could have had. I didn't have, because of my culture, my conditioning, the fact that I could afford a Gore-Tex jacket and a rucksack and I've got clean water and oatcakes to take with me. And I had the realization there is suffering inherent in life. We have to take care of our bodies, that is suffering. We have to take care of our minds, that is suffering. We have to take care of each other, that is suffering. Okay, so just to be clear, the Buddha did not say life is suffering, which you sometimes get from some translations. What the Buddha is saying is that suffering is an inevitable part of life that we have to sort of take on, accept, turn towards. And the Buddha chose suffering as opposed to happiness being an inherent and inevitable part of life because he realized it's the one that we don't want. It's the one we're trying to get away from. Suffering is the one we're trying to get away from, or deny that it exists, or fix. So that's why he chose to say, look, the first noble truth is suffering is an inherent part of life. If we stop trying to get away from it or deny it or fix it, then we're on the path. The poison, the causes that we want to fix it, deny it or get away from it. I also had another Gore-Tex moment while I was writing this talk, because it was only a few days ago. I was out on our lawn in the sun. Then I realised I had to go in and get my sunglasses. Then I was out on the lawn writing it and I got cold, so I had to go in and get a blanket. And eventually I had to go in because it was too cold. and the wet ground, and I thought, oh no, I better go and get a chair to sit on because I don't want to get wet. So I was actually having it in that moment as well, so I just thought I'd mention that. Okay, so traditionally there are seven forms of dukkha, which we all will experience at some point in our lives, or we'll experience them in our friends' lives. So first one is birth. So you can imagine, and I don't want to go too much into the trauma of giving birth, there's Laura in the room. Those of you that have given birth already will know it's not a pleasant, necessarily, and unpainful process for both the mother and the baby. Okay. Two. Old age. This is when we start losing the ability to see as well, hear as well, memory loss, our bodies not doing what we would like them to do as easily. Sickness. Everybody in this room will have had at least one childhood disease and, you know, colds over winter. It's always suffering. Whenever I get a cold, I think, oh, why me? This is terrible. It's awful. I don't like it. Don't want it. You know, all of that stuff. The big one, death. That is death of people close to us, death of loved ones, and also our own death. Five, I'm just going to read these and I'll write them up later. Contact with what one dislikes. So that's being around things we're not particularly keen on. The sixth one, separation from what one likes or who one likes. So you could think of that in terms of people. So you've got a person that you work with that you don't get on with. That's contact with someone that you dislike. Or you might have already encountered food that you weren't so keen on when you got here. That is contact with something you dislike. Separation from what you like. The food that you normally have at home. Lovely, yum, yum, my nice things. Separation from all your loved ones, your friends, your family. Pets, all those kind of things, coming on retreat can be separation from what you like. And the last one, and sometimes the most insipid, and actually the one that can cause us the most suffering, not getting what we want. So I'd like to invite you to kind of explore dukkha in your life, not at the expense of also holding on to things that are beautiful, happy, joyful as well. It's not that you kind of dip into life. So let me just say it again. It's not that you're dipping into life is suffering. It's just that you're acknowledging and turning towards the fact that suffering is an inherent part of life, and holding that alongside the inherent parts of joy and happiness as well that also exist alongside that. So it's a really beautiful image. You see some bodhisattvas, sort of a balanced view. So you might already know what kind of person you are. You might be like me, the kind of person that just denies, ignores the fact that suffering is in existence, and just kind of move, just saying, no, no, it's happy, it's gorgeous. People just need to get over it. Shush, don't talk about death, that kind of thing. Or you might be a person that's just like, oh, this is dreadful. Life is really difficult, really tough for everybody, and overwhelmed by this, in which case you might need to bring more awareness of happiness and joy into it. So you've got a kind of balanced view. That's the idea. So once we've explored this truth for ourselves, worked out where we sit, turn towards both and accept them. So something beautiful and happy and joyful happens in your life, turn towards it, accept it, and then let it go. If something suffering, trauma, something like that happening in your life much harder. Turn towards it, accept it, and let it go. So ideally we'd be embracing both. We'd embrace the suffering, we'd embrace the happiness, hold it in ourselves, hold it in others, friends, family, at work. And we're doing that with as much awareness, as much mindfulness, and as much kindness for ourselves and the other person as we possibly can have. So this is all the ideal, obviously. Sometimes what we actually feel when we're faced with either suffering in ourselves or suffering in another person is horrified anxiety, aversion, denial, or we just want to slide the elephants under the carpet and put the carpet on top again. Okay? And you might especially notice this in your own life when something tragic or traumatic happens for you. So I particularly noticed this when my mum died. I was 28 when my mum died. And I wasn't one of those people who kind of, I didn't do a big outward grieving thing. And I also haven't ever criticised any of my friends for what was going on for them. But I'm just going to give you some of the responses I was having from friends at that time. Because I was quite young, not as young as some people here maybe. But I was quite young. So my friends were used to me kind of being an outgoing, party-loving kind of girl. And suddenly that changed. So some of my friends went into horrified anxiety. They offered too much help or pity, and it became more about them than about actually what I needed. So they were, you know, constantly phoning me and making me talk, and I would say, look, I'll ring you if I need you. No, I'll ring you tomorrow. And it was more about them than what I needed. So that's horrified anxiety. Some friends didn't ring me at all. And I didn't sort of let go of them as friends, but they did just kind of ignore it. They didn't know what to say. It touched into the potential that their own mother might die. They didn't know how to meet that grief at all. And then after a few months, most of them had completely stopped asking anything about it. So some of you might have had this experience as well. And again, I didn't blame or criticize. I just noticed. I just kind of noticed, oh, well, it's not okay for me to talk about this anymore for them. So I had to find how to do that for myself. So, yeah. And also in that, just so it's not like all about my friends, I also had my stepdad's grief. Me and him had a really tricky time in those first 6 months because we grieved in a completely different way and neither of us could really turn towards each other. So I think, you know, that's the task, is trying to turn towards each other even when you're both in that difficult situation as well. On a lesser note, some of you would notice it if you're on Facebook or social media. You have some people who are constantly saying, life's brilliant, I'm so happy, everything's going really well, I've got a great partner, great job, all this is great. And you've got people who are constantly saying, oh no, I'm ill again, or this is terrible, I can't cope. And you've got people in the middle who mostly are doing everything's great, and when they do something is difficult, you'll see the horrified anxiety in the news feed underneath of all their friends saying, oh no, why you, how could it happen, it's dreadful. So just noticing and watching out for it, not criticizing it. So I suppose that space for us is just to notice. Is this suffering? Is this happiness? Am I turning away? Am I turning towards? And there is a point of freedom in that, rather than being blown along with it, either intoxicated with the happiness and the joy, or overwhelmed by the grief and the suffering. So it's kind of like holding those two. So I'm going to do that image again of balance. It's called equanimity, holding both. Okay, so we're going to do a few little activities to just explore this together. So for the first one, you'll need pen and paper. Did anyone not see the note to bring pen and paper? I've got some spare. Great. Take a couple of sheets in case you write a lot.